You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
I'd like to welcome you to this webinar on auto enrollments, sponsored jointly by Brookings and the American Enterprise Institute. To begin, a persistent impediment to getting closer to universal coverage has been the reality that large numbers of people who are eligible for free or highly subsidized coverage are not enrolled. The Urban Institute has estimated that 25% of the uninsured are eligible for Medicaid, and another 25% are eligible for marketplace coverage with financial assistance. Overall, it's been estimated that 35 to 40% of the uninsured qualify for coverage that is absolutely free. Perspective that's been coming up, coming up with an approach to auto enrollment is critical to achieving universal coverage in a multi-payer system. And it's not surprising that policy thinkers on both the left and the right have been working on approaches to using an auto enrollment process. This made it a good topic for Brookings and AEI to work together in sponsoring this webinar. We're privileged to have five panelists to speak, all of whom have been thinking, working on this issue for some time. Each of them will make remarks reflecting their perspectives on how we can practically and effectively bring more auto enrollments into health insurance. And each will comment on how their approaches navigate the political constraints that they perceive, as well as the formidable administrative constraints. After the panelists have completed their initial remarks, I'll pose questions to the group as a whole and then turn to questions from the audience. If you have questions, send them either to events@brookings.edu or use Twitter, and it's the hashtag autoenrollments. So I think we'll turn to our first panelist, Kristen Link-Young from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everyone. Great. Thanks so much for being here today. As Paul mentioned, we could cut the uninsured rate in half by enrolling those who are eligible for coverage into the program for which they are eligible, either Medicaid or subsidized coverage in the individual market. This insight is a big part of the reason that auto enrollment is such a powerful policy concept. So what do we mean by that term? The word auto enrollment tends to encompass two related ideas. The first is what I call push-the-button auto-enrollment, situations where the consumer becomes fully enrolled into health coverage without having to take any action. The phrase auto-enrollment is also used to refer to strategies that require some sort of affirmative action by the consumer, but make enrollment far more seamless and automatic than it is today. And I think you'll hear me and other panelists today talking about auto-enrollment in both of those senses. So why haven't we done auto enrollment already? There are four big challenges to auto enrollment. First, to auto enroll someone into coverage, we need to know who they are, and then we need to have enough information to truly know what form of coverage they're eligible for, not just have data that suggests their eligibility for a coverage program. Under current law, getting that kind of determinative information ranges from hard to basically impossible. So getting there will require changes to our eligibility rules, generally to make eligibility more stable and predictable over a period of time. The second big challenge is that we have to collect a premium. Some of the uninsured can qualify for zero premium coverage, which makes auto enrollment an easier task for that group. But for others, we need some source of payment, which can make true automaticity in a coverage program challenging. Third, we need to figure out what plan we're going to enroll someone into in an auto enrollment program. And then finally, we need to understand that whatever auto enrollment system we build isn't going to be 100% accurate. And so we need to create something that is robust to those kinds of errors. So those are big challenges, but they're not insurmountable. And I think there are two basic ways to get there, to sort of put the pieces together and enable some sort of auto enrollment system, both of which I'll talk about a little bit more. The first is retroactive enrollment. And the second is strategies where you target a specific group at a specific moment in time in order to enroll them in coverage. So retroactive enrollment is, in my view, the best way to get to truly population-wide auto enrollment. The idea of this type of program is that for anyone who is uninsured, we would say that they were covered by a backstop health insurance plan that sort of operates in the background, regardless of whether the consumer is even aware of it, much less has taken any action to sign up. The backstop will pay healthcare claims for any person who's otherwise uninsured who needs to access the healthcare system. And in exchange, everyone who is uninsured must retroactively pay a premium for the backstop plan, typically when they file their taxes. And the premium would be owed regardless of whether or not the person used healthcare services in the year. This is obviously a big change from the way we think about enrollment today, and that it effectively makes enrollment into coverage mandatory. But I think it's actually less disruptive to our current system than it may sound, largely because it operates within our current patchwork healthcare system. And because it operates at a population level, it's the path of the path towards universal coverage that is, in my view, most feasible. But we also have other options in this model of targeting specific populations or moments in time. One area of particular interest is tax filing. You're going to hear more about auto enrollment at tax filing from others on the panel today, but based on some simulations we've done here at Brookings, we find that 31% of people who are uninsured at the time they file their taxes look like they are eligible for a zero premium option, either through enrollment in Medicaid or a $0 marketplace plan. So if we had a way to auto-enroll that group of people at the moment they filed their taxes, we'd reduce the number of people who were uninsured in December, several months later, by about 25%. So a small fraction of the group we auto-enrolled would gain employer coverage throughout the year. So this is a powerful tool that can get a whole bunch of people enrolled in coverage. It's not a path to truly universal coverage, but it is nonetheless a really useful step. Another way to think about auto enrollment targets is to think about moments when people lose coverage. For example, prior to COVID-19, more than 400,000 people every month exited employer-based coverage and became uninsured. A lot of those people interact with the unemployment insurance system, so state UI agencies can play a role in facilitating enrollment. State unemployment insurance websites can promote health coverage information to consumers as they apply for and recertify benefits within the unemployment insurance workflow. Or as UI agencies think about modernizing their technology, they can also consider options to integrate health coverage within the unemployment insurance application and recertification process. So creating a really sort of truly streamlined and unified experience for consumers. That kind of model would also work in lots of other benefit programs where you would take consumers who were interacting with a state agency and integrate the health coverage application into the other process. So these are just a couple of examples, and I look forward to our discussion about ideas like these. I think, Jim, it's over to you.
Here I come. Get my slides up. Okay. Can you all see my slides? I assume you can, yes? Thank you very much for having me on the panel today. This is a very important and good topic for us to be discussing right now, as lots of people are about to lose their health insurance, as Paul sort of hinted at in his introduction. Obviously, what to do about that will dominate the conversation, I think, in the coming months. And some of the ideas that were just presented and some more that are coming, I think, throughout the presentation today can be helpful as policymakers try to grapple with, I think, is going to be a pretty immense challenge of a spike in the uninsured rate in the coming months. So just to bring a slightly different perspective into how to think about this, I think the points that Kristen just made were very, very good and relevant. One other framework that might come in is, of course, that because of the complexity and the newness of auto enrollment, perhaps we ought to begin initially with a state option. That is, that the federal government create a structure around which the states can explore various approaches to dealing with what is going to be a challenging and complex endeavor to start a new way of putting people into health insurance. And so working with Stan and Lon Heave, two of the other panelists today, we thought through a couple of years ago what that might look like in terms of a state option. And I think it does begin with a federal statute that the federal government should try to put into place some kind of incentive program that brings both financial resources to bear on the question and also new authorities and tools that the states could use to build an auto enrollment program. The amount of money, depends on exactly what would be intended in terms of startup funds. But I think we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billion, a billion, but not that much, certainly not in the context of money that's being spent right now on the recovery program. So in the scheme of things, this would be a fairly small investment, mainly aimed at helping the states build the systems that are necessary to do what Kristen described as sort of point in time enrollment efforts rather than the full retrospective approach. Okay, so what could this look like? I think it should be a grant to the HHS with funding to allow a state-administered program within a federal structure that funds would support, first of all, building an IT program and programmatic infrastructure. There's going to be a need at the outset to, as you'll see from other conversation I think we're going to have today, that to be able to do this right, you're going to have a lot of access to insurance registries to be able to cross-check who's enrolled in what, as well as their income to be able to get this right. When states apply for this, there should be some elements that they present to the federal government about exactly how they would go about this, some sort of requirements for the application, so to speak, a little bit along the lines of when they apply for Medicaid waivers. But basically, they should be indicating how they will build an IT infrastructure to facilitate it, how will the consumers be assigned to health plans, and what rights and options do the consumers have both before and after assignment to a plan. I think consumers auto-enrolled into insurance should be held harmless for income fluctuations during that year. One of the big complexities here is when someone is auto-enrolled into a program, what happens if their income changes sort of midstream? And I think one of the things we have to understand about all of this is that we've built a multi-payer insurance system that is incredibly complex, way too complicated, really, on a number of levels. And one element of it is to realize that people do have changes in circumstances, often good ones, where their incomes go up. But instead of penalizing people repetitively and quickly, this ought to be something where if they get auto-enrolled into a program, they're held harmless for a period of time and given the assurance that you're going to be in this regardless of what happens for the next year or so. And that allows them to, I think, have some more confidence that being auto-enrolled into something isn't punitive, but it will be helpful to them. And then the big piece of this is really around what can the federal government do to make this easier for the states to explore this kind of program? And I think the first one is related to what I just said, which is to allow states to establish full year eligibility for the federal premium tax credits and Medicaid based on prior year state tax information. So you just say, if you're going to do auto enrollment based on last year's income level, as you determine through your tax system, we will use that and no other conditions are necessary for the next year or so. And that can become the eligibility determination for premium tax credits for that period of time. Second thing I think is to provide, you know, data sources really that allow them to handle this new responsibility better. This is actually number three on our list here. What data can the federal government provide? Federal employee coverage data, Medicare coordination of coverage data, health plan ACA section 6055 data, that's data that has to be reported by the plans, health self-insured coverage data through ERISA, so you get rid of an ERISA exemption for this purpose and allow states to at least find out who's in the self-insured employer plans. And you can add an element around health insurance to the National Directory of New Hires, which is something used for child support enforcement very rigorously by the states, to include a health insurance component that would allow better cross-checking of who's already got insurance. I think another element here is that states ought to be allowed to auto-enroll anyone into a catastrophic plan. Right now, the ACA limits that to people 30 and under. And then finally, and I'll stop here, encourage states to be creative about using other existing citizen touch points, unemployment insurance, DMV applications. Those seem to be two very good places where people are coming into contact with state government and could be reminded about options about health insurance and allowed to auto-enroll into a program during that process. Thanks.
Thanks very much. I think I'm the next person up. And it's really exciting to be here today with such amazing thought partners. Can everybody see my screen? Let's see. There we go. Let's see. Share screen. Here we go. All right, terrific. So we're going to talk about using the tax filing moment as an opportunity to jumpstart eligibility enrollment into coverage, whether automatically or in a streamlined fashion. And we'll talk first about why that's a good context. Second, some early results from Maryland's experiments in this area. And third, some state and federal policy implications. So to begin with, why income tax filing? Here, let me try to make this a little better here. So why use income tax filing as a place to start enrollment? Well, to paraphrase the famous saying associated with Willie Sutton, because that's where the uninsured are. A tremendous percentage of uninsured folks eligible for assistance file federal income tax returns, either to claim earned income tax credits or other refunds, or because they're legally required to do so. There's really no other venue where you can reach as many uninsured as with tax filing. And serendipitously, tax filing also has all kinds of data associated with it from which eligibility can be determined. So there's obviously the information on the form about income the previous year, but there's also a Social Security number for many tax filing, which agencies that run health programs can use to obtain other data needed to establish eligibility. And there are other benefits as well. There are limitations. And for the purposes of this conversation, the most important limitation is that you need to have proactive opt-in mechanisms for data sharing rather than opt-out mechanisms. For our revenue collection as a country and states as well, we depend on largely voluntary compliance with tax forms. People need to feel comfortable knowing that even illegal income generating activities or unethical ones they don't want to share with their neighbors can be put safely on the tax return. And if tax return data is scattered hither and yon, people may be less willing to come forward and share that information, and we lose revenue as a result. So unlike other contexts, here it's important for people to affirmatively consent to data sharing. So inspired by some of these insights, lawmakers in Maryland passed an easy enrollment bill in 2019. It garnered enormous bipartisan support, a unanimous state Senate vote, for example. And the basic concept is when you file your state income tax return, check a box if you're uninsured, and you can say, please, revenue agency, share my data with the health insurance exchange and have them see if we qualify for free or low-cost health insurance. Most people file electronically, and that could potentially provide a venue where we have real-time eligibility determinations, where somebody finds out right then and there, you file your tax return, you learn you're eligible for Medicaid, you're automatically enrolled into Medicaid unless you opt out. With exchange coverage, we tried to push the idea of automatically enrolling people into free insurance, insurance where the premium is completely paid by the premium tax credit. But one of the main carriers in the individual market objected, and so we're not going forward with that yet, though some of us haven't given up hope of moving in that direction. The bill was signed into law in the middle of 2019, and less than 7 months later, state agencies were involved implementing it. Unbelievable, unbelievable cooperation and effort on their part. It's a three-phase approach. Phase one is underway right now, where state officials leveraged existing processes to enable quick implementation. So the tax agency sends batch files to the health exchange. The health exchange does a preliminary eligibility determination, does a mail campaign sending out notices to everyone who checked the box describing their likely eligibility for assistance. And then people who get the notices are told that they can sign up by using the standard procedures, going online to the portal or calling the 1-800 number, et cetera. That's the initial phase. Later phases are going to be more electronic. We're starting with professionals with for-profit tax prep companies and then eventually moving to everyone. People who e-file can get that automatic real-time eligibility determination followed by expedited or ideally automated enrollment. But that's going to be for the coming years. Now, for year one, the phase one approach, we were not expecting huge numbers based on past experience. Several states had tried similar direct mail campaigns with children based on state income tax returns and gotten less than a 1% take-up rate. The federal government did a major direct mail experiment, which was incredibly important, demonstrating the mortality effects of health insurance coverage, but it increased participation. It increased coverage levels by just 1.3 percentage points. So we were not expecting much, but what we got was really striking. Nearly 40,000 people checked the box on their tax return and asked to have their information shared with the exchange to determine eligibility, and nearly 3,000 have enrolled into coverage. Really a strikingly high percentage for a direct mail campaign. And it's also striking to see who has actually received coverage. So most of the enrollees have been Medicaid folks, 71%. Most have been low income. Fully 26% are children. Most are young adults. Relatively few are in high income ranges. So this suggests a lot of promise if this is representative of what broader efforts may bring in the future. So there are a number of different state policy implications. Everybody wants to be one of the best states, and Maryland's results suggest that other states could profitably follow along these similar lines, including states that use the healthcare.gov portal. Those states could use this to help get Medicaid coverage for people who are eligible but not enrolled, including children. There are other lessons learned from the process through which this thing was implemented. Unbelievable involvement of all the state agencies in crafting legislation, of stakeholders, including plans, providers, consumer groups. Tax preparers have had a central role, very important to take their concerns into account. So it's really been a marvelous process that other states could learn from. In terms of federal changes, I think Jim did a phenomenal job talking about the kinds of federal changes that could be needed, giving additional flexibility to states to use data to determine coverage, and having state pilots that are supported by the federal government. The federal government itself could use individual income tax filing as a launch pad. As Kristen talked about, you'd have to revise eligibility criteria to accord with the available data. Jim talked about that as well. You might want to think about changing the enrollment cycle so that tax filing can be used as the time when people generally enroll into health coverage. You'd need, as a practical matter, to give a lot of IT money to IRS. IRS's information technology, as we all have recently been reminded, is underinvested in. It needs modernization for this and for other purposes. And you need to think about challenges to full automatic enrollment. States may have concerns about their caseload going up, even though it consists of eligible people, and carriers may be concerned as well. But is this the time to talk about it? We're all dominated by COVID-19. That's the topic of the day. And Charlie Parker gave us the answer half a century ago. Now's the time. We have huge numbers of people who are losing employer-based coverage. Most of them are eligible for some kind of help, but we know historically most laid-off workers do not enroll in coverage for which they qualify. It's just overwhelming to be grappling with job loss, and therefore it becomes imperative to make enrollment as easy, seamless, and automatic as possible. Tax time is one option. As both Jim and Kristen noted, unemployment insurance is another option. And thinking about the pandemic, now is the time we need people to get health insurance so that folks who come down with the illness quickly get care as soon as they start to feel sick. That's good for their health. It's good for their neighbors and family members' health as well, because it enables prompter detection of the disease. And in terms of the economy, healthcare losses have been enormous. And if we see torrential losses in health insurance coverage, that means less revenue for hospitals, doctors, and clinics. That means more job losses. So if we want to fight both halves of the COVID crisis, the health half and the economic half, health insurance is critical, and automatic enrollment is an important recipe to any successful approach to health insurance.
Thanks very much. Great to be with this group of people. I know all of whom have worked very hard on these important ideas. And so what I thought I would do today is to share with you some thoughts about, hopefully everyone can see this, about kind of operationalizing auto enrollment and thinking about some opportunities for using and deploying auto enrollment, which I think Stan did a great job of outlining at the state level, how they've done that in Maryland. And I just want to talk about a couple of thought experiments that I've done in concert with a few others in thinking about how to use auto enrollment. So let me do this. I'm going to go to the presentation view. Hopefully this will work. There we go. So, to start, you know, I think we've covered some of this, which is the challenge in operationalizing auto enrollment is sort of multifaceted. Identifying a population, figuring out who fits in, actually enrolling them, activating them, effectuating coverage, and reconciling whatever assistance they might get at the end of the day, it does create a number of logistical challenges. And so I think it's important to start with the premise and the question of who is it that we're trying to help? What is a population group that might be a useful sort of start in thinking about this? And, you know, Jim Capretta and I have talked in the past about looking at folks that might qualify for example, for some kind of zero premium or significantly reduced premium coverage, ideally zero premium coverage. And so I think focusing on that part of the uninsured population that falls into income categories where they would be able to look at a significant amount of assistance in effectuating coverage is a good place to start. So in thinking about the analysis, you can start by defining the problem a little bit. So a lot of this is drawn from in my presentation from 2019 data, and a lot of this comes with the assistance of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. If you look at the numbers carefully, you begin with this sort of set of about 15 million people who are uninsured, and this excludes those with access to affordable offers of coverage in the employer context, those with access to public health coverage, and those who are not lawfully present in the U.S., which is obviously three relatively significant groups of people. But let's just start with this group of people to begin with. These numbers obviously are going to look different with the COVID crisis. So let's just put that caveat aside for a moment and recognize that we're looking at a group of people before the crisis hit. And what you can see is that there's actually a relatively significant number of people, about 4.2 million, who fall into the category below 133% of FPL, another million in that increment between 133 and 200, 2 million in the 200 to 250, and then a relatively more sizable number over 250% of FPL. So this just gives us a sense of the context that we're operating in, okay? If we look then at what percentage of the low-income uninsured can access free bronze coverage under, again, 2019 data, what we see is that the vast majority of rating areas, in fact, almost all rating areas across the country, could offer $0 bronze coverage for people in the 60-year-old category, and then a little bit less in the 45 and the 21-year-old category. But the basic point is that almost all of the uninsured between 133 and 200% of FPL could have access to free bronze coverage, again, using 2019 data, which I think is a really encouraging thing if you're trying to figure out where you start, right? Because sometimes in thinking about the problem, it can be so large and so significant that you don't necessarily know, well, okay, where do we get started? What I've encouraged policymakers to do in my conversations with them is, you know, it's okay to start small, or it's okay to start with a portion of the population or part of the population who could benefit from coverage or could benefit from an auto enrollment style approach. If you look at the number of uninsured who could access free or low cost silver, you actually see that a significant number of silver plans could be accessed for relatively low premium, not zero premium in many cases. Although for 60-year-olds, you will see on the far right, my far right that I'm looking at now, that there are a number of rating areas where the premium would be zero even for a silver plan. But even at that 21-year-old level, at 133% of FPL, what you see is that the vast majority of the country offers access to silver plans for a relatively low premium. And so I do think that these last two charts sort of demonstrate the degree to which you might be able to gain access to either bronze or silver coverage across the different age strata for people who are pretty low income and could really benefit from automatic enrollment. So, you know, another way to think about this is there some way to start with a smaller group of people even than those group of people that we were talking about? And that is, could you auto-enroll young people who are aging off their parents' plans, whose incomes fall into 133 to 200% of FPL level? Again, the goal here being for policymakers to be able to define a population with which to pilot auto-enrollment. And as you will be able to see in a minute, a large percentage of this population in particular, according to analysis that's been done, can access zero premium bronze coverage with an APTC, with the tax credits available through the ACA. I think the big question that we often get is, you know, how scalable is this? And I think it's a fair point. To Stan's analysis, I really do think that the state level is the key place, the key locus of activity, because that's really where I think in some states you could see this being the core of an experiment that then radiates outwards with other sort of people, other populations potentially being included based on the needs and the situations found in those particular states. And so this next chart that I'm going to show demonstrates the percentage of 21-year-olds at 133% of FPL who could have access to free bronze coverage after their APTC, after their premium tax credit. And what you see, first of all, I will readily admit this is a not that significant percentage of people, right? We're talking about 50,000 individuals nationwide who are estimated to be uninsured, who are 27 years old, and who fall into this income category. Okay, so we've now taken the overall pie and we've shrunk it down into an interesting thought experiment pilot group. And what you see is, sure enough, 95% of rating regions across the country, including 100% in many states, big states too, like Texas, what you find is that the vast majority of this sort of pilot population we're talking about could qualify for $0 bronze coverage after applying the APTC. And so there is some sense that for this population, auto enrollment might be a good solution to get people covered. And it might be a good way of thinking about how you can take a concept that I think the other speakers on the panel really elegantly outlined and try and put it into effect for a small group of people who could potentially really benefit from it. And as you can see, for many, many people in this population, they would be able to access zero premium coverage and be enrolled into coverage that would certainly help them prevent serious economic calamity in the event that we have a crisis strike such as the one that we've seen. So I'll probably end my remarks there, but I'll just briefly point out, I know David's going to get a lot more into this. There are some political considerations to think about, namely that, you know, a lot of Republicans that I've been in contact with this have expressed the need for strong opt-out concerns. They clearly have what I would characterize as liberty concerns, as well as concerns about being involved in more widespread implementation of the ACA. And then I would say on the other side, Democrats have generally been pretty enthusiastic, although I think the challenge there is maybe a little too enthusiastic in the sense that they have said, for example, well, why don't we start with auto enrollment of Medicaid populations, which obviously gets conservatives, many conservatives, somewhat concerned. And then the last thing, which we've touched on, is sort of the state versus federal issue, which is how much of this belongs at the state level, how much of it belongs at the federal level. I think those are open questions. Certainly the federal level could be involved in providing some funding, in providing some guidelines. But ultimately, I do think this is going to be a state-based endeavor fundamentally, and it's going to require that coordination from the federal government with the state governments together. And with that, I will conclude.
Thank you, Lonnie. That was that was awesome. I think my role on this panel right now is to bring it back up to the 10,000 foot level and sort of talk about the political appeal of auto enrollment. And you've heard a lot of great analysis and sort of taking of the benefits and making them really visible for people. So what I want to do is basically talk about why I like auto enrollment, which is, it keeps it simple. A lot of healthcare policy is complicated, and as we know. And, auto enrollment makes enrollment easier to get coverage for people. It creates a safe default choice for consumers so they can't go too far astray from when it comes to their healthcare coverage. If somebody forgets to enroll or gets overwhelmed by the choices, they still get coverage. And today's discussion, I think, has made it clear that as we're grappling with auto enrollment for people who forget, we're also going to make it easier for people who enroll themselves. So right now I want to cover three topics. The first is the appeal of auto enrollment across the political spectrum. And I want to talk then about examples of auto enrollment in current law. And then some of the political challenges that despite the appeal of automatic enrollment, we've heard from a little bit from Lonnie about that. So first, let's look at some key pieces of legislation that include auto enrollment. Perhaps the most automatic of all is the Medicare for All Act, which has automatic enrollment because everybody is automatically entitled to coverage and then automatically enrolled. The Medicare for America Act contains two kinds of auto enrollment. The first is a default enrollment for a public plan for the uninsured, and the second is automatic enrollment at birth. And then in the Patient Freedom Act, Senators Cassidy and Collins proposed enabling states to do auto enrollment, as Lonnie and Jim have talked about. Next, amongst various think tank proposals, we see a lot of ideological diversity. As Brookings and AEI have made it already clear, they're on the vanguard of making automatic enrollment a part of their proposals. Kristen just discussed how the Brookings proposal is retrospective, so you get automatically enrolled retrospectively in coverage. The AEI proposal calls for as much automatic enrollment as possible, doing it in an incremental way. And then we also have the Urban Institute plan, which includes auto enrollment for the low-income individuals, as well as automatic enrollment for people in receiving food stamps or welfare. And then in Medicare for Extra for All CAPS plan, it's a basis for the Laura and Schakowsky bill, which includes the automatic enrollment for the uninsured, and default public plan, and automatic enrollment at birth. Our third way proposal, cost caps and coverage for all, we kind of combine the Brookings and AEI approaches. We have as much upfront automatic enrollment as possible in a private plan, and then a retrospective enrollment in a public plan for everybody who's left as a backstop. And lastly, we all remember fondly when Stuart Butler was at the Heritage Foundation, he proposed automatic enrollment as an alternative to the individual mandate. So the popularity of auto enrollment has already become embodied in the law. I mean, let me give you a few examples, not a comprehensive list. Medicare Part A is automatically enrolled. It's actually hard to kind of get out of it, but you can. Medicare Part D has a low income automatic enrollment for the subsidies for Part D drug coverage. We also have kind of forms of automatic enrollment through auto enroll and renewal and Medicare Advantage and exchange plans. There's also this thing called express lane eligibility for CHIP and Medicaid, where you don't have to you just have one set of information from one application for multiple programs. And lastly, in employer-based plans, we saw retirement really get this whole movement started. One study showed that when you have automatic enrollment in retirement plans, participation rates are about 86% compared to 46% without. So with automatic coverage having such strong support across the ideological divide and such strong legal presence, you might be wondering, why hasn't Congress already enacted this? Well, you know, as I said, healthcare is complicated. We've heard that. And I see three key challenges. Four. So the first is, what are we enrolling people in? Is this going to be just another version of an individual mandate? See, the truth is we don't have a political agreement on what the standard for default coverage is. Is it a health plan with essential benefits as defined in the ACA, or a short-term plan that doesn't have ACA protections? Or is it the plan that the states get to determine? That's a big problem. We kind of touched on that today. The second problem is the fiscal impacts. We would be increasing coverage quite a bit, and that's going to have a big impact. Now, I know right now we're not supposed to be worrying about, costs because of the COVID crisis, and that's appropriate, but eventually we're going to have to start thinking about our long-term sustainability of budgets. And, that relates to the third problem, which is that, as long as there's an unorganized group of people out there, it's going to make it hard to get a big push in Congress to get this done. Just make a little bit of fun of it. There's no organized constituency for people who forget to do things or get overwhelmed by their choices. Now, they're great advocates for consumers like Families USA, but it's going to be hard to organize around automatic enrollment, as Stan would love to do, but it's going to have to be really coupled with broader coverage and push for universal coverage. And the last challenge is implementation. As we kind of touched on already, some consumers will inevitably be confused about their enrollment and what they're getting. And even if they can opt out, which they certainly should be able to, they may experience some dissonance over that. And they may be confused about how to switch to another plan if they don't like the plan they're enrolled. So ultimately, the political challenges are significant. It comes down ultimately to doing the right thing. Elected officials are going to have to be convinced it's worth the risk and that the appreciation will come later. And I think that's kind of what happens with health policy. You may remember a lifetime Republican from Wisconsin who wrote President Obama thanking him for the Affordable Care Act, which saved his life. This is what he wrote. To my president, I have a pre-existing condition and so could never purchase health insurance. Only after the ACA came into being could I be covered. Put simply, to not take up too much of your time, if you are in fact taking the time to read this, I would not be alive today without access to the care I received due to your law. The president did read that. He posted it online. And I can easily imagine the next president receiving such a letter after auto enrollment is enacted and Americans find that it has given them the protection that they ended up needing. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, thanks. I'm unmuted. I want to thank you all for really thoughtful presentations. And I've got some questions to pose to you as the group. I think you're going to have to unmute yourselves, unless the AV wants to unmute you all now. See who has something to say. Good. First, I want to talk about doing auto enrollments on a state or federal level. And it's not surprising that we're focusing on states today, because we've always seen states as the laboratories for experimentation in public policy, and that's certainly happening. And of course, by doing things on the state level, we get away from some of the hostility and gridlock associated with the ACA. But I wonder what your thoughts are about, if auto enrollment really turns out to be something that works well, people supports. Is this something that's ultimately better as a state activity with federal government supporting all the states and doing it? Or is this something that would work better as a federal activity?
Well, I guess since I did the state presentation, let me jump in here, and I'm sure the others will have some thoughts too. I think actually this is something where, let's imagine we wanted to write a federal statute. I think unless we did the retroactive enrollment option, sort of the big one, you know, where you just sort of placed everybody into a plan of some sort, it's not entirely clear to me that we all would agree on or even know exactly what to put into a federal statute to do auto enrollment easily at the moment. It's a pretty complex endeavor. And I think there's such a differentiation across the states in terms of how they're thinking about their insurance markets, that, and also frankly, levels of capacity to engage in this, that maybe that's an argument for the federal level, but I think what I'm trying to say is that I'm not even sure we'd be ready to write a federal statute that would make this easily done. At least I wasn't sure I would know how to do it. So this seems to be one of those things where, and also let me just say one other thing about the framing of this. United States, after the ACA, we got to 90, 91, 92% of coverage at this point. After the pandemic, it obviously seems like the uninsured rate's going to go up. But there is a structure now in place to try to get, at least in a normal environment, to 90-plus percent coverage. And let's say you ask the country at that point, what do you want to do to take care of the last 10%? There's a lot of people proposing various programs to do that. But when you tell them, as Lonnie's slides indicates, and everybody's information has indicated, that the majority of people who are uninsured are actually eligible for something, I think it really changes the conversation quite a bit. And people say, well, why don't we try to make what we already have work better, and they get into what they're already eligible for before we create another program. And I think I think that means that, you know, we're in maybe a little bit of a long slog. Let's imagine the federal government did do what I recommended, you know, create some kind of federal structure, some seed money to the states. They start experimenting. I think it could take 5 or 10 years to figure it out how to go from 90% coverage to, you know, 98. Maybe California would get there first, but I think that's maybe the recipe the United States might have to follow.
Yeah, I have a slightly different perspective. My answer is both and. That states really are where a lot of the action is right now. And obviously we're doing work in Maryland. We've done work, we've had conversations with people in other states to try to follow in Maryland's lead. So that's the immediate challenge. And I think Jim is completely right that we will learn a lot, hopefully, from what states do. And there's a tradition in the country of healthcare innovations beginning at the state level and then eventually becoming national, whether that's with the Children's Health Insurance Program or Medicare Part D or the ACA, which was piloted in significant part in Massachusetts. So hugely, there's definitely a role for states. And I think the ideas that Jim outlined in terms of things the federal government can do to give a boost to state efforts are absolutely right on the money. On the other hand, if we do in fact see in the coming months an opportunity for a major federal coverage expansion, auto enrollment should be a part of the design. It's not enough just to have, say, if you build it, they will come. You need to think about how exactly do they come, how do they enter, and how do we make it as seamless and simple as possible for people to get coverage. So if we have a major federal effort in the coming months, this will be a part of the conversation. Also, if we have the existing coverage system in place, I definitely could see an opportunity for some middle-level tweaks making a huge difference. So if we were to say, sort of picking up on Kristen's idea about changed eligibility criteria, and also, you know, Jim talked about this as well, saying that prior, and I think Lonnie did as well, saying that prior year tax records can determine current eligibility for subsidies. That would let lots of people be enrolled into coverage and filing when they file their income taxes, whether into Medicaid or into zero premium marketplace coverage. So I could see some opportunities for federal action as well. So we're opportunistic at Families USA. Whatever opportunities we see for coverage gains, we're going to seize them and take and do the best we can with them.
And I just want to underscore that last point that Stan made. There is absolutely a role for state experimentation here, but you do need some federal policy infrastructure to enable that state experimentation. Every single one of us talked about what uninsured consumers are eligible for. But in fact, none of the data sources that we are using demonstrate what people are eligible for under existing law when it comes to the private insurance market. Under current law, eligibility is a calculation that's made at the end of the year based on sort of what happened during the 12 months, and consumers make a projection themselves based on their own private knowledge during the year. And so no automatic system can replicate eligibility the way it works under current law. So to enable the kind of experimentation that we're talking about, you do need federal policy changes that tweak the structure of eligibility so that a tax entity or an employer who sees people turning 27 and aging out of the employer plan or whoever it is, someone can sort of take existing information and treat that as authoritative to put them in coverage. And so that's going to be a federal policy change that's necessary for any of these ideas to move forward.
But just to add one sentence on that, I think that's a very important point and ought to be considered. You know, our health insurance system is way too complicated, and allowing prior year tax or prior income information to determine what you're eligible for in the following calendar year is an eminently reasonable thing to do. And something so complicated, and you don't want so much churn and uncertainty. And honestly, you know, they ought to just make it easier for people to stay in that coverage for some period of time. Stability in the coverage is important, and maybe this can be part of the conversation that goes a little bit beyond auto-enroll, which is what information should we be using to determine eligibility, and does it really make sense for this complicated premium tax credit retroactive reconciliation process, which honestly they're not doing that well anyway and probably are missing, you know, all kinds of things that are supposedly reconciling. So I think simplification, using last year's information, making it easier to use the tax system to put people into coverage, federal and state, Stan, I'd be willing to look at both. I think that's the way to go.
And let me just add to that. There's lots of other areas of our policy, that federal policy, which we use retrospective qualifications, like the student loans. I mean, all that is done on prior year taxes. So that's a good point to make as well. But let me also then echo, you know, what the political motivation here is going to be. The biggest thing that people worried about are costs. And if an elected official running for president, say, is going to come up and say, we're going to protect everybody from high costs, well, part of that has to be coverage. You can't protect people from high costs unless they have coverage. So I see this, debate fitting nicely into a federal debate about where we go next with coverage. Now, of course, I totally agree also with Lonnie and Jim that, you know, the states are going to be where the action takes place. So we've really got to do both, but it's as Kristen said, it's got to be in a federal, it should probably be in a federal, will have to be in a federal context. Let me put it that way.
You know, I just thought of something that, you know, so much of the work we've done on auto enrollments has happened during a period of strong economy, economic stability. And now, you know, the issue, the urgency of the moment is what about all this massive amount of unemployment? Are a lot of people going to lose coverage? And what can the federal government do, either through the states or its own, to reduce that impact? And you start thinking about, you know, like prior tax data, you know, will not help fast enough to deal with something. So I almost wonder if there, you need to have a, you know, more than one approach to at least be available during our current challenge.
And I think the FAFSA analogy that Dave brought up is a great one. So our student loan system, which reaches high into the income spectrum, I think it is analogous to health coverage in that way, and that it is not just a very low income group, but a large segment of the middle class as well. The FAFSA process is based on your family's prior year tax return, but you also have the option to get additional assistance if you have had a major change in circumstances. And there's additional documentation requirements if you are in this category of seeking additional assistance. But we sort of start with the idea of letting the tax return do the work, and then people who have had a significant change can get additional assistance without, as Jim mentioned, penalizing people who have sort of an improvement in their circumstances. So when I think about these kinds of policy changes, that's the model I'm imagining, where we sort of reduce the complexity for most people and enable auto enrollment to function at scale, whether that's in a state or whatever, or you know, in a pilot program, but to actually function at across a group of people. But you also preserve some complexity there for the people who really need it because they've had a massive change in circumstances or something like that.
Yeah, I would just add, sorry, Stan, I would just add that the current condition, the current economic condition, where we know a lot of people are probably going to be displaced from employer coverage to the extent that, for example, they worked at a smaller business and smaller business offered coverage, which is more limited to start with, I recognize. But this would seem to be one of those scenarios that would be ideally suited to auto enrollment. Now, having spent a little bit of time over the last 2 weeks kind of thinking about how you would operationalize it, it is a challenge. There are any number of different challenges, but you could imagine some states trying to take up the mantle here and figuring out, okay, we've got a group of people that's no longer on employer coverage. Could they easily be bridged into a marketplace plan that would offer similar or substantially similar coverage that would also be available at a cost point to them that's similar to what their premium contributions may have been under employer-sponsored plan? So that's just the theoretical framework you apply. It's obviously much more difficult in this situation because people are churning between jobs. Potentially, hopefully, when the economy begins to recover, they might get an offer of coverage again. You know, there are issues involved there. But certainly for this period of time, I do think it bears thinking about whether, in fact, there is some way of continuing people from their employer coverage into an affordable marketplace plan. I mean, I think certainly that would be a more affordable route than, for example, subsidizing COBRA continuation coverage, which, you know, may be the best available option out of very few options at this point. But still, I would think auto enrollment would be an interesting and potentially attractive alternative.
Yeah. Lani, do you think it's feasible that this could actually show up in a federal COVID relief bill, and in the sense be one more example of how responding to the pandemic, changes policy more dramatically in areas than we would have any right to envision otherwise?
I would say, Paul, in just the conversations I've had, I think it's only going to be feasible if you can identify a group of people to start with. And it can't just be, you know, everybody who's lost employer-sponsored coverage in the last 3 months, although we would want in an ideal world to help those folks transition to marketplace coverage. I think it's got to be more narrow than that. So this is why I've been kind of racking my brain trying to figure out, is there a subset of people who's been economically displaced and displaced from coverage who could, who could find their way into a good marketplace plan? I mean, one sort of basis of inspiration for this is there's actually a few carriers in a few states, as I understand it, anecdotally, who have offered to essentially transfer the deductible, the spending toward deductible in an employer plan to a marketplace plan. So in other words, if you've spent $200 out of your $500 deductible, you would get credit for that spend against your deductible in a marketplace plan as if it were your employer plan. Now, this is not happening widely. I've just heard that it's happened in a few cases in a few states. But that's an example of the kind of thing that would make a transition into marketplace coverage much more seamless during a time when people clearly could use it. So I think we have to start thinking creatively. And by we, I really mean everyone on this call and everyone who's listening. about, are there specific target populations that we might be able to propose as a demo, for example, that could make it in, very well could make it in, to some kind of relief package later this year?
Thank you. Stan, I think you were waiting to speak before.
Nope, that's okay.
Okay, good. Let me go on to another question. How do other advanced economies or countries with multi-payer systems, for example, Germany, Switzerland, Netherlands, how do they use auto enrollment to achieve universal coverage?
I think I'll jump in here because actually Paul and I talked about this in advance, and but I'm sure others might have some information here as well. It's interesting to look at these countries because particularly the Netherlands, that they do have multi-payer systems, private insurance, and they have, all of them have an individual mandate. And it's actually much more rigorously enforced than anything we were thinking about doing before the tax penalty was repealed in this country. They're pretty tough about it. And the auto enrollment feature is really tied to their systems of tracking down people who are not insured and then going through a series of hoops with them, trying to get them into a plan. And then the ultimate step is just to put them into a plan and then start trying to make sure they pay for it. So for instance, in the Netherlands, they a few years ago, they set up a special data registry to try to kind of collect, sort of a little bit the same kind of thing we're trying to do at the state level through that legislative structure I was proposing earlier, is to give, they set up essentially a matching system of registries to figure out who is uninsured in their country using the insurance plans that are regulated by the country in the state. And if someone is sort of recalcitrant and not signing up, they actually then just place them into the competing plans in the country on a proportional basis based on market share. And then they assign the premiums that are owed to that person and have a number of collection authorities that they can then implement over time to try to extract the money out of the person. So in some sense, our task should be a lot easier than it is in the Netherlands, right? Because what we're trying to say essentially is, hey, we're already giving you the money to pay for a premium, as Lonnie said. Please take it and we'll sign you up for a plan. So the amount of coercion of trying to extract some money out of the folks will be a lot less, I think, in our auto enrollment system than they even are in these other countries where they're really tied a little bit to enforcement of an individual mandate. Switzerland has a cantonal system where the cantons enforce their mandate, and it varies a little bit across them. Basically, they have, at the end of the day, when they always start with a number of other things where the person voluntarily signs up. But if the person doesn't sign up, they then assign them to a plan. And again, they go through a collection process to get the premiums. Germany has a very small private insurance alternative to the sickness funds. I can't quite tell, but I don't think they have that much auto enrollment in the plans. It's much more of a enforcement of the individual mandate.
Thank you. Any other comments on this question, or should I go on? Let me go on. What have we learned from initiatives by employers that use auto enrollment for retirement plans? Are any employers using such an approach for their health benefit plans?
I know a little bit about the employer retirement system. I got to say, I don't know for sure if there are any doing employee health, but on the employer retirement side, which is obviously a lot easier, the basic story there is that it has boosted enrollment into 401ks quite substantially. There's some question about whether or not because they're putting them into a certain tier of contributions, whether or not if the person did it on their own, they would have contributed more. But in general, I think the body of evidence would indicate that this has worked fairly well to boost coverage. And the really important point is that once people are in, they don't ever opt out again. They're given plenty of opportunity to get out if they want or to change the selection. So this, as Lon, he indicated earlier, there's a lot of inertia that drives non-enrollment. And I think some Americans may think, or some, on the conservative side of the political spectrum, there could be some point of view that sort of says, well, you know, we ought to give people the option to not participate because that's their constitutional right. You know, maybe perhaps so, but honestly, most people aren't invoking a constitutional right not to, you know, sign up with health insurance. What they're doing is they just are busy with other things in life and they're not signing up. And so I think the reaction would be, like it has been in 401ks, if we did a lot more auto-enroll, even through employers, I think most of the response from the people who get auto-enroll will be, oh, golly, thank you. I'm glad I got this. I did, you know, it's one last thing I have to worry about now, rather than you violated my rights.
You know, I think
actually, I do think I think there are sort of two dynamics that make auto-enrollment into health insurance different in the employer context than into a retirement benefit. And the first is when an employer auto-enrolls you into a 401k, the employer is largely spending your money. Sometimes there's a matching contribution, but they are primarily spending your money in enrolling in the 401k. When they're enrolling you into a health insurance plan, they're primarily spending their own money because, of course, employers offering employer-sponsored health insurance pay between, you know, 70 and 85% of the premium. And so the sort of financial incentive for the employer is a little bit different. The other, I think, important dynamic here is affecting employees' eligibility for premium assistance in the individual market. So, of course, under current law, people who are offered employer coverage, but for whom that coverage is very expensive, are able to receive a premium tax credit if they decide to forego their employer coverage and opt for marketplace coverage instead. And so there's some concern that employers, by auto-enrolling employees, may be firewalling individuals from sort of better, more affordable coverage for their low-wage workers in the marketplace. And so I think that has sometimes been a concern. I think that has perhaps been sort of overblown at times. On the other hand, the employer can manipulate its own liability under the employer responsibility requirement potentially in this way, which could be a cause for concern. So employers have generally tread lightly here. One thing that has come up, and Stan uses this word a lot, is employers do more commonly use sort of a forced choice. They don't, in a lot of employer health plans, it's not possible to just not answer the question. Your HR office is going to keep hounding you until you tell them yes or no to the health coverage that they're offering. You're allowed to opt out, but they're not going to let you be quiet. They will keep bugging you until you tell them yes or no, which is not quite the same as auto enrollment, but may achieve some of the same benefits.
Yeah, the other big difference with health coverage in the employer context is that you might be turning down the employer plan because you're covered through your spouse's plan. For auto enrollment to work, you need to know that the benefit that you're enrolling people in is going to be something that folks by and large value. And if you have a large percentage of people who don't because they're enrolled in their spouse's plan, that's a problem. That's a challenge. But I want to underscore the point that Jim made, which is the success of auto enrollment in the employer retirement savings accounts really shows that it can offer enormous potential with health coverage too. And I'm thinking about when in Louisiana, when they did the closest thing we've come in Medicaid to automatic enrollment with the Express Lane eligibility program, where they mailed families cards. This was under Bobby Jindal. Health Medicaid cards to families and said, your child is eligible for Medicaid based on SNAP. You can consent to enroll by using the card. By the end of the year, more than 80% of the families had used the card. We did some focus group studies when I was at the Urban Institute, and we talked to these families, and they loved it. People who had not used the card said, it is just such a source of peace of mind to know that if anything happens to my child, I can go to the doctor and it's going to be covered. There was like not the kind of pushback we were concerned about. People just loved it. So I think Jim is right. If we design it right, people may like it a lot. Now, one of the reasons that the one carrier in Maryland pushed back against automatic enrollment was the argument is, well, a lot of people who are enrolled, they won't like it. They're going to call us up. They're going to complain. I'm hopeful that we could see our way toward, at least towards testing it, towards pilot testing it in part of the state. And my hope would be that the carriers would see that, in fact, people are happy to be enrolled in coverage that doesn't cost them anything, that provides them with some access to coverage and care. So I think Jim makes a really good point there, as usual.
No, good. Actually, I just wanted to add to that. I think, you know, almost, you know, a profound change in thinking in economics, you know, has come in the last couple of decades as far as behavioral economics, the notion that people sometimes can make better decisions with help. And the notion that, I guess, the Nobel laureate Thaler came up with, it was a nudge. And then I think it's probably some of the intellectual basis of auto enrollments, you know, most people would actually be very pleased that this happened to them and that we ought to help them, but, you know, with a gentle enough nudge that we're not taking their freedom away. Let me go to another question. Actually, I think we've done a good job on that one. Yeah, any comments on the political needs to avoid what turn out to be overpayments and underpayments in subsidizing coverage?
So I can start on this one. I think an overpayment and an underpayment is what the law defines as an overpayment or an underpayment. In my view, the way we should be approaching this is to define eligibility in a way that makes overpayments and underpayments sort of not the same problem that they are today, rather than considering it an overpayment if last year's tax return said your income was 178% of poverty, but now your income is 201% of poverty, and so, you know, that's an overpayment. We can just say last year's tax return was sort of good enough for us. I do think we have to acknowledge that I said this at the beginning, but our system is not going to be perfect. We'll put people in Medicaid when they should have been in the private market or vice versa or whatever. And so we just need to build a system that doesn't treat those things as an error or a failure, but rather as kind of the inevitable impact of running something across a large population. And so cost is important, but I would want to avoid this language of overpayments and underpayments, because an overpayment is what you define an overpayment to be.
Which brings me to, I want to raise one issue here, which is related to all of this, and very much agree with that point, which is if you did a state-based experimentation program, I could imagine a state like Maryland or another state saying, wouldn't it make sense for us to use prior year tax information to do all this? And also shift our regular enrollment for the exchange process into the spring and not have it in the fall. So maybe the federal structure should allow this as sort of a waiver idea and go July 1 to July 1. And so everybody's income from the prior year will count for eligibility for Medicaid and premium tax credits July 1 going to the following July 1 based on the prior calendar year tax information. And honestly, you know, you just make it a lot easier for everybody if you just did it that way. And, you know, I could see a state kind of coming to that conclusion once this federal structure put all this in place, gave them the information, gave them the authority to do it, and we could see what happened. I think it might actually work a little bit better than the process we have now where you're trying to, you know, put them into eligibility based on everybody trying to, you know, guess what their income is going to be in the following calendar year.
I see two panelists nodding heads and would like to give you the opportunity to follow up on what Jim said.
Just to say I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Stan, don't you have a problem with July 1st? Don't you want to do it a little earlier in the year?
Those are small details. The point is I agree.
I just wanted to make sure the states had time to, you know, process all that tax data.
And good point. Some questions have come in the two ways I mentioned. Remember, events@brookings.edu or Twitter, auto enrollments. And they keep coming in, so I have to move my screen. Several states do not have broad-based income tax. How would auto enrollment, if at all, work in those states? From Chris Farrell.
Stan, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So a couple possibilities. One is, particularly in the current environment, state workforce agencies, which run unemployment insurance programs, I think are a critically important place to look. As I mentioned earlier, you know, we've tried many times in the country's history to enroll laid off workers into health coverage, whether with the health coverage tax credit program passed in 2002, COBRA subsidies passed in 2009, now the ACA. We've generally failed to reach this population because people are just overwhelmed and struggling with the challenges, both emotionally and practically, of I've lost my job. What does that mean? Who I am as a person? How do I get unemployment insurance? Do I get SNAP? People do not have the bandwidth, generally speaking, to deal with health coverage. So this is a really important opportunity to figure out how can we make it as light a lift as possible for people. So what we're suggesting to folks is, and the unemployment insurance agency themselves are overloaded right now, so they don't have much space to do huge innovation. One possibility would be the state health agency, either the exchange in a state-based marketplace state or the Medicaid agency, writes an email for the UI agency to send all of its UI applicants. This seems to me like the lowest hanging fruit. And let the unemployment insurance recipient or applicant just, you know, click the link, go to a web page maintained by the health agency, and just provide contact information and social security number and say, please reach out to me in the following way, you know, email, text, cell phone call, and sign me up for coverage and walk me through the process. That would require the health agency to invest resources in doing the individualized follow-up, but that's the kind of thing that actually get people enrolled into coverage. That's one option. The other place to look, it seems to me, is driver's licenses, particularly now that we're doing real ID. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, no matter how you feel about real ID, it means that states have a lot more data about us in important ways, and that may be a useful place to go in states that don't have their own income tax systems.
And Dave?
Yeah, just let me add that a state that doesn't have its income tax, it's a really good question because it really shows the importance of doing both federal and state policy at the same time. That state without a state income tax could have access to the federal income tax data. When I filled out the student loan applications for my kids for college, you know, there was an automatic download that I agreed to from the IRS to my FAFSA application. We could do the same thing for states who don't have an income tax.
Really good points. Anyone could speak to, besides Maryland, which states have been most active in pursuing auto enrollment experiments?
Well, Massachusetts has done some interesting things. They've got these a lot of great academics who've been working with the exchange there and figuring out what kinds of nudges work most effectively with people and what sort of auto enrollment strategies work. We've gotten inquiries from states like Colorado, New Mexico, Virginia, Maine, Pennsylvania. But a lot of that interest went away when COVID hit. I mean, that's, you know, really very much front of mind for people. And although this is important, there are other topics that understandably have gotten the limited bandwidth of short legislative session decision makers that have come to the fore. So we had some interest early on in the session. We still have some interest in a number of states, but I don't know how many states are going to be following Maryland's lead this year.
Thanks. Okay. Got a question on Medicare enrollments, which may not be relevant. Let me just read it. The Medicare enrollment process is extremely confusing and complicated, especially compared to Medicaid or the marketplace. How does Medicare auto enrollment fit into the conversation? This is somewhat of a broadening, which I think I know the answer, but if anyone would like to take a crack.
Well, you're automatically enrolled into both Part A and Part B fee-for-service at age 65, unless you essentially opt out if you started applying for Social Security benefits by that point. if you haven't applied for Social Security by that point, then you have to find a way of paying your Part B premiums. You can, of course, elect to take Medicare Advantage as opposed to fee-for-service A and B coverage. That requires an overt opt-in, and you have to go through the Medicare managed portal for looking at your options, deciding which coverage you would like. You also have to do similarly for Part D for prescription drugs. So it's sort of a mix. And in addition to all of that, if you go into Medicare fee for service, which many people do, about half of new enrollees are going into fee for service, half into Medicare Advantage. Those who go into fee for service also at that time have to figure out if they want supplemental coverage. And that is a different enrollment process through a different portal. So I would agree with the questioner in the sense that this whole process needs to be reorganized to be a little bit clearer to people about what their choices are and what the implications of them are. But this is that's a big topic that goes well beyond what we're talking about today.
Thanks. Yeah, actually, to me, the Medicare auto-enrollment, so we had a system, but then as people started working longer, beyond 65 and not needing Medicare Part B, we kind of created a new problem of people who don't enroll. You know, because Medicare has a very powerful call it a mandate, where if you don't enroll in Part B when you're supposed to, your premium is higher for life and goes up based on the number of years. But I think that's a very specific Medicare issue that probably is outside what we've been discussing. Got some more questions here. What protections are being put in place to ensure personal data privacy? This is from Michelle, I can't pronounce, Kulikowskis, Cultural Vistas.
Yeah, so data privacy is really important here. And it's critical that whatever state or federal agency is handling this information handles it with care and is subject to strict agreements about how the information is used. Certainly we need to ensure that consumers' personal information is not being exposed by state agencies that are assisting in health insurance enrollment or anything else. I don't think auto enrollment poses sort of new or different challenges on data privacy issues than the underlying systems that exist. State Medicaid agencies, state tax agencies, their federal equivalents already have access to a large amount of information that needs to be protected. And so I agree that protections are critical. I don't think the questions here are different in kind from what we are already dealing with and what the statutory infrastructure is already set up to protect. And in certain ways, I think our longstanding sensitivity about how and where tax data in particular gets shared have really hampered a lot of auto enrollment activities. Our attitude towards federal tax data in particular is that it can't go anywhere for any purpose absent an express statutory authorization, with some nuance that we don't need to get into here. And so that really makes it difficult to do something like the Maryland experiment as well as it could be done. If there was more robust access to federal tax data, if we opened up the situations in which state agencies could use federal and state tax data, we would be able to layer on the necessary privacy protections and really do a lot of good. I think we also are similarly, there's another major database, the National Database of New Hires, which is used for child support enforcement today and very, very few other things, but it's similarly potentially really powerful in facilitating enrollment. And again, the types of privacy protections we would need are the kind that already exist under current law. And so sort of opening up those databases for this kind of project, I think could go a long way and could be done in a way that is absolutely respectful of consumer privacy.
I agree. One point that's sort of interesting in terms of data architecture, the Federal Data Services Hub, which is the way that lots of different federal data sources have been made, and private as well, have been made available to exchanges and state Medicaid agencies. It doesn't operate as a federal repository of data. It's a federal doorway through which you can ping the underlying data sources maintained by separate agencies. And that's an important element of the architecture that reduces the risks of security breaches and privacy losses.
Okay, thanks. We're nearing the end of our time. And before signing off, I'd like to give each of the panelists an opportunity to state any final thoughts they have reflecting on our conversation.
So I'll start. I have really enjoyed this discussion. One of the things that is most striking for me in conversations like this one or others that I've had privately with you all and others is that anybody who thinks seriously about operationalizing auto enrollment at any meaningful scale is thinking about changes to our eligibility rules. That it's not possible to tackle this policy problem without reimagining the way we do eligibility to make it more stable and more predictable over time. And that's coming from the left and from the right. It is a prerequisite to serious efforts in auto enrollment. And so I think that is one of my main takeaways from this conversation, that there are lots of different ways to tackle this problem, but they almost all start with some reimagining of the way we do eligibility for healthcare coverage programs.
I would just add, I think it speaks volumes about the promise in the kinds of policy solutions that we've all talked about, that you see the kind of ideological diversity that's represented here, as well as the kind of really what I think is technocratic. I mean that in the kindest sense of the word, you know, our sort of technocratic approach to trying to figure out how we can facilitate enrollment in this way, because I do think it speaks to one of those rare opportunities when right and left might work together to make something happen in a really meaningful way.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's just such a joy to see at a time of tremendous partisan strife that people with different perspectives can work together and figure out a way to solve problems that help people's everyday lives. And in terms of the notion of technocracy and simplification and all that, you know, Dave's point about making it simple, it's, I think about it in terms of, the things we're talking about are complicated. And yet the goal is to make it simple to computers. I think about like a car. I have no idea what happens under the hood of my car. I know there's a carburetor, it's run by a computer. All I know about, all I care about is I push one thing and I go, I push another thing and I stop and I turn the wheel and it's easy for me. A lot of complicated engineering beneath the hood makes it possible for me as a person to make it a really easy driving experience. That's what we want to do for health coverage. And it may take a lot of engineering and work behind the hood, and we may have to get our hands greasy and Lord knows what we're going to have to do, but the goal is to make it really simple. It's a complicated system we have now, and whatever we can do to make it simpler for people, we're going to get a lot more people health coverage, and that'll be good for them and for the country.
Thanks. Actually, I think carburetors went out of cars a couple of decades ago.
Shows you what I know.
Echo what already has been said. I think if the United States is going to have a multi-payer system, which we probably will, you know, absent some other things happening, I think we probably will have a multi-payer system for some time. There's only one, you know, way to move forward, which is to try to make that multi-payer system work a little bit better in terms of getting people into what they're supposed to be in based on their current life circumstances. And, you know, given the ACA and what it set up, attached to the employer system, attached to Medicaid, attached to our retirement Medicare program, you know, how do we make all of that work a little bit better with each other as people move around and have different changes in their life circumstances? I think auto enrollment could be a very big part of that. And I very much agree. Simplicity, you know, complicated engineering out of sight, simplicity for the consumer, getting general bipartisan agreement about, you know, what happens when and, you know, what are the options for people at what point in time. and you know, getting the employer community also to participate in all of this. I think all of that could go a long way toward being in a better place 5 years from now than where we are right now.
Good. Dave, if you'd like, you've got the last word.
Sure, just real quick, tremendous thought and ideas that we've heard today are good signs for the future of health policy. Even if we end up having a fight over health policy like we seem to have, inevitably, there will be a lot underneath that girds that effort, like auto enrollment, to make the system better. So yes, regardless of the politics, no matter how cynical you are about the politics, this discussion is going to be essential to like moving forward as we you know, try to get people covered and protected from high costs.
Yeah. Thanks, Lyle. You know, my long experience in health policies, I've always thought of we consort healthcare policy issues. And there are some where partisan differences don't come in. Doesn't mean that they're easy. Often stakeholder differences are what limits what we can do. But anyway, that's very encouraging that auto enrollment might be, in concept of multi-payer systems, might be in that nonpartisan category. I want to thank all of you. Your presentations and your discussion comments were all very, very valuable. And I'm really glad we could get together on Zoom to do this. And I look forward to seeing you at least virtually again soon.
And thank you very much to Brookings and AEI for sponsoring this event. Really, kudos.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you to all of you for participating. Thank you. And thanks to Paul for stepping up and moderating. It was really,
absolutely
really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take care.
Thanks, everybody.